Hey, everybody. Welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
And I'm GeekWire civic editor Monica Nicholsberg.
All right, Monica, I knew that you were going to be reporting this week on a big hearing out of Washington, D.C. involving Facebook and Google and Amazon. And was Twitter there, too?
Apple.
So I assumed that the story would be about Facebook and Google, you know, the companies with like the real privacy issues, or at least the ones that have been focusing a lot on privacy.
The ones that get a lot of attention.
Exactly. So what happened?
That was not the case. It was all Amazon. And actually, this week, the theme of the week for me was Amazon and antitrust, because there were a lot of different things happening.
All right. So on this episode of GeekWire, we are going to be talking about the case against Amazon and Amazon's response to the concerns about its position competitively and antitrust issues. So let's start with just a big overview. What's going on? Why are people focusing on Amazon now? And what are the key issues that people are bringing up?
So big tech is under a microscope right now for a variety of reasons. We've had a year and a half of scandals and data breaches that have really brought this to the forefront of people's attention. And at the same time, we have record income inequality, and Amazon has really become emblematic of that with its, you know, it's got this stratified workforce, really high paid tech workers and lower paid warehouse workers. It's got a huge appetite for growth. It's helmed by the richest person in the world. And in this kind of politically divided moment, apprehension about the power and scale of the tech industry is this rare issue with supporters on both sides of the aisle, at least in the US. We're also going to talk about Europe. But the point is that a lot of factors are converging to make this an issue that's just getting a lot of attention from regulators and lawmakers.
But and not to jump too far into the weeds here right off the bat, but I thought Amazon was all right with its warehouse workers. Didn't they raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour in the US last year?
They did, yes. And Amazon will be the first to tell you that they're very proud of the benefits and pay that they offer to warehouse workers, but not everyone sees it that way. We know we're just coming off of Prime Day, their big kind of manufactured shopping holiday, and we saw a lot of protests and demonstrations and actually some strikes around the world from workers who say that the conditions inside these warehouses are really hard charging and need to be relaxed.
So that is one issue, and there was another back and forth this week between Amazon and Senator Bernie Sanders and presidential candidate Bernie Sanders on that topic. But for me, the high drama was this congressional hearing that happened. And as we said, Amazon ended up getting more scrutiny through the questions than any of the other three tech giants that were there. Why did Amazon face more questions than the others did?
So I think that Amazon is a little bit easier for regulators to get their arms around in terms of its business model. It's obviously a very innovative company, but it's operating a marketplace. It's selling goods. There are things that regulators can look into in terms of how it behaves competitively and compare to past cases that I think is more challenging when you think of a company like Facebook or Google, which has this very disruptive business model, and they're offering free services to consumers. So it's harder to pinpoint where the actual harm is, because traditionally antitrust cases have looked at pricing and especially pricing for consumers.
It struck me that some of the most pointed questions during this congressional hearing came from U.S. Representative Pramila Jayapal, who represents the district that Amazon is in. She represents Seattle and a couple surrounding areas. She set this up in a really interesting way.
Thank you all for being here. My district has the great honor of long being a place for innovation, a place where many small companies became large giants, including Amazon. And it is also a place where, in the past, innovation has had to be protected by the federal government. And specifically, I call your attention to, in 2001, the Department of Justice sued Microsoft, accusing the company of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act by using a monopoly to adversely affect the web browser market. And the case later settled after Microsoft agreed to make it easier for Microsoft's competitors to integrate their software with the Windows operating system. And there are many scholars out there who believe that this case is actually the one that opened up tremendous space for real innovation that wouldn't have otherwise existed and allowed a whole new wave of tech companies to spring up. And some of the companies represented here today actually flourished after that court ruling.
This fascinated me. There is a certain element here of rewriting history. There is a real argument to be made that the government failed in its efforts to corral Microsoft's business practices. And what they actually did, the Justice Department, through its lawsuit against Microsoft, was distract the company to the point that these other competitors were able to come in and win things like search and then mobile phones. And the actual remedies themselves didn't have that impact in the same way. That said, it was an interesting way to frame it. And I have a hard time buying that.
That's really interesting to me because I was not tuned in during the, I was a child during the Microsoft antitrust drama, but I am very tuned in now. And so hearing from folks who are paying attention then is really interesting to me. So you're saying that whatever the objectives of the government were, they were not really realized in the way that they were trying to realize them.
No, the remedy at one point was to split the company up. I mean, Microsoft bought a second campus in the Seattle area in Issaquah with the idea that one of the two companies, the two mini Microsofts, would be in Redmond and the other would be, you know, up on the Issaquah Highlands. They never said that explicitly, but it was pretty clear. And as soon as the antitrust case went away, they got rid of that property over time. So, yeah, I mean, there were some severe remedies that were being considered. In the end, the government was able to have a tighter rein on Microsoft's behavior, but it wasn't the kind of structural change that would have led on its own to the kind of opening up of the markets that the representative is speaking about there. So I would dispute that.
Another thing that's interesting to me about Microsoft and Amazon in this case, and we should couch it by saying that experts think it would be very hard to pursue an antitrust case against any of these companies. But what is it about Seattle that, you know, are we just getting up to all kinds of anti-competitive shenanigans up here in our cloudy corner of the world?
I think it's just the fact that stuff that happens here matters everywhere, as I like to say.
Geekwire's tagline.
Exactly, exactly. All right. So Microsoft notably was not at this hearing, which is interesting because it is the most valuable company in the world. It's just that it has been able to sidestep a lot of these criticisms currently, and in part because it still makes money from, you know, old-fashioned sales of cloud services now versus software, but it's not making the bulk of its revenue from things that rely on personal information.
It's a more mature company. It had its turn in the hot seat and learned some lessons from that younger upstarts are maybe learning now.
Diving into the case against Amazon, the main representative there at the congressional hearing before the House Judiciary Committee was Amazon Associate General Counsel Nate Sutton. He made the case for the market, the relevant market that Amazon operates in. And this to me was one of the most significant points that he made, even though it's not new, about how you define the overall retail market. So let's listen to what he said.
Online is not a separate market, it's just another channel. We know customers shop both online and offline, and the evidence shows that prices have converged between online and offline. With respect to online, Amazon is one of the leading retailers. But there are many other retailers, including Walmart and every other major retailer who has a large online presence, as well as just online players such as eBay.
So this is critically important because the key threshold question that antitrust regulators look at is the relevant market. So are you dominant as a company in the relevant market? And so Amazon is saying, sure, yeah, we may dominate the online channel of retail sales, but we are not the dominant retail player, and the larger retail market is the relevant market. And so that then makes an antitrust case much harder to pursue. Did the legislators who were there buy that?
It didn't seem like it was very convincing to them, no, but it is a really critical component of this because the way you look at it makes a huge difference. If you look at overall retail, let's just say in the US, Amazon is about 4% of overall retail, which includes the drugstore on the corner and everything online. If you just take the online slice, they're 37.7% according to eMarketer data. That's a dramatic difference, and it's been one of the main points Amazon has brought up. Every time these antitrust issues or rumblings start to surface, Amazon says, look at the overall market. We are competing with everyone who's trying to sell you something. And that's up for debate.
So what is the specific problem that legislators and potentially regulators in the U.S. are looking at related to Amazon?
The main focus of the questioning during this hearing was Amazon's third-party sellers. So Amazon.com, when you go on there and you buy something, you could buy it directly from Amazon, or you could buy it from thousands of third-party sellers who are using the Amazon marketplace to sell you their own goods. Now, what regulators are concerned about is that Amazon is scooping up all of this data on what's doing well and using it to gain a competitive advantage over third-party sellers. So, for example, if Amazon sees that Hydro Flask water bottles are doing really well in the marketplace, they could theoretically make an in-house insulated water bottle, sell it for a third less, and promote it on their website. And then they potentially could be using their power to gain an unfair advantage.
This was the subject of several exchanges during the hearing between different representatives. I want to play some extended clips. Let's start first with Representative Jayapal setting it up and then asking questions.
Essentially, you have this massive trove of data, right? People that are buying products on your platform. And so you're able to see which are the ones that are doing really, really well, like that size 14 pant or that houseware that's being sold. Do you track that? And then do you create products that directly compete with those most popular brands that are out there?
Thank you. Let me answer that question. That data on popularity of products, like much retail data, is actually public data for each of our products. You can see where it's ranked. You can see how popular it is. We do not use any of that specific seller data in creating our own private brand products. And private brands is an area where, quite frankly, we lack behind many of our retail competitors who have 20 to 80% of their products as private brands, where we're only in the low single digits. We do offer private brands on occasion because we think it offers high value and low cost items for customers, and because customers demand that, and we want to provide that opportunity for customers.
Believe it or not, Monica, the people on the panel, the representatives there in the committee hearing, they didn't buy that.
They were not sold.
All right, let's listen to a little bit more. Here is the chair of the committee asking more questions of Amazon.
I think we see a tremendous concentration of economic power that is fundamentally shaping markets in a way that are often unfair, unbalanced, and not competitive, resulting in less choice and worse quality of products and services for working people. We want to make sure, as part of this investigation, that we're doing everything we can to make sure our competition system is working for the entire economy, including small and local businesses in our community. For more than half of online commerce, retailers and manufacturers of consumer goods are reliant on Amazon as a commerce platform. But as we know, and as Ms. Jayapal's question revealed, Amazon also offers its own products on the platform. So, Mr. Sutton, initially I want to say, doesn't that create a conflict of interest?
Thank you for the question. Respectfully, we disagree. We partner very closely with our third-party sellers. We rely on them to provide broad selection and prices to our customers, and we've been very proud of our investments to help them grow to be a majority of our store and growing twice as fast.
That's a different question. What I'm saying is you are selling your own products on a platform that you control, and they're competing with products in the marketplace from retail, from other sellers, right?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. That practice, I think, has been common in the retail industry for decades. Most retailers offer their own products in their store as well as third-party products.
So that was Representative David Cicilline asking questions of Amazon Associate General Counsel Nate Sutton, and it got even more heated from there.
But Mr. Sutton, the difference is Amazon is a trillion-dollar company that runs an online platform with real-time data on millions of purchases and billions in commerce and can manipulate algorithms on its platform and favor its own product. That is not the same as a local retailer who might have a CVS brand and a national brand. I mean, it's quite different. So I want to drill down a little bit on the question that Ms. Jayapal asked you. You said we do not use seller data to compete with other sellers online. You do collect enormous data about what products are popular, what's selling, where they're selling. You're saying you don't use that in any way to promote Amazon products?
Let me answer
that. And I remind you, sir, you're under oath.
Yes, thank you for your question. We use data to serve our customers. And to clarify my question, we don't use individual seller data to directly compete with them. And again, similarly, with respect to some of the
data,
most...
Do you use consumer data to favor Amazon products? Because before you answer that, analysts estimate that between 80 and 90% of sales go to the Amazon buy box. So you collect all this data about the most popular products, where they're selling, and you're saying you don't use that in any way to change an algorithm to support the sale of Amazon-branded products?
Our algorithm, such as the buy box, is aimed to predict what customers want to buy.
Sir,
and we apply the same criteria, whether you're a third-party seller or Amazon, to that, because we want customers to make the right purchase regardless of whether it's a seller or Amazon.
But the best purchase to you is an Amazon product.
No, that's not true.
So you're telling us, sir, under oath, Amazon does not use any of that data collected with respect to what is selling, where it's selling, what products, to inform the decisions you make or to change algorithms to direct people to Amazon products and prioritize Amazon and deprioritize competitors?
The algorithms are optimized to predict what customers want to buy regardless of the seller.
Those are just a few snippets. I realize we played some extended clips there, but it was a long hearing. How many hours?
I would say close to two.
Yeah, so we're just getting a glimpse of it. Was this representative of the overall tone? And let me remind you, you are not under oath.
Thank you for your question. Yes, it was representative of the overall tone, I would say. I think they were not buying what Amazon was selling a lot of the time. And
they were not Prime members in this hearing.
They were not subscribers,
to this particular line of reasoning.
They probably all are Prime subscribers, though, which kind of gets into the nature of the beast. But anyway, I thought that exchange was really interesting because eventually the chair got Nate Sutton to say, we don't use an individual seller's data to compete with them. And that's a pretty key word because it means, yes, we might not be going onto Hydro Flask's page and saying, here's the best thing that they're doing and making an insulated water bottle to compete with it. But it doesn't speak to whether or not Amazon's using aggregated data from thousands of sellers to inform its decisions and whether that raises an antitrust issue. I mean, it might not.
Their big thing to say, though, is that their private label team or the team that is selling their own products is only using data that anybody else could get from their website. That's Amazon's contention here. It's kind of hard to believe. And that's where I can see why these questions are so pointed.
Right. They said that popularity data is public. Anyone can go on Amazon.com and see what's doing well. I also find it hard to believe that Amazon's engineers and the people responsible for making private label products just go to Amazon.com and say, all right, what's doing well here? You know, you'd have to think that the engine's a little more sophisticated than that, but we don't know.
So the backdrop for this was a couple other related news stories. First, one was involving Facebook, which was also part of this hearing. The FTC issued a $5 billion fine against Facebook that had been long anticipated. And I read the stories about this and the reaction from a lot of the lawmakers, and many of them seemed unsatisfied by that fine against Facebook, which is just sort of a drop in the bucket for that company. Did that dissatisfaction or lack of satisfaction impact the mood? Did you see that play out at all, even in subtle ways?
I think that it set the tone, and it really reflects the fact that we're in a very unique moment because this $5 billion fine is the biggest that the federal government has levied against a tech company. So that's a big deal. And yet it was received as a drop in the bucket, a slap on the wrist, as something that was not going to be significant enough to cause Facebook to meaningfully change its behavior around privacy. And what that says to me is, number one, the profits of these companies are just mind-boggling because they can be making so much money that $5 billion won't make them change their behavior. And the other is that there is a big appetite among some members of Congress to rein in this industry. Now, there's not a lot of agreement about how to do that, but clearly this fine and this hearing show that they are not satisfied with the current regulatory tools that are in their toolkit that allow them to exercise some control over this industry that's become so powerful.
Now, that's interesting because I know that one way that regulators, legislators can go after companies on antitrust grounds is by showing that they had an impact on prices. In other words, they're using a monopoly position to raise prices for consumers. Of course, that's not the case with Amazon. If anything, they're using a strong position in the market to lower prices but then to, in the process, go after competitors like Main Street retailers, whether or not they say explicitly that they're doing that. Obviously, one impact of Amazon and its overall strength, and you could say the same thing for Walmart, frankly. I see this in my hometown in Northern California. Big companies that come in with huge price advantages and economies of scale can have a massive impact on the market. And yet that wouldn't be the traditional antitrust argument because they're not raising prices. So why doesn't Congress just change the law?
Well, it's a good question. Congress has a pretty easy time changing laws.
Well, not right now, though. Oh, you're being sarcastic.
I missed
the sarcasm. Go ahead.
No, Congress can't make a law to save its life. But I think that's a really important point. And that's why experts say that while there's a lot of noise right now, it's not likely that we will see an antitrust case because none of these companies fit into the traditional mold that you would need them to fit into in order to prosecute successfully. Our laws are very focused on consumer prices and, you know, Google and Facebook, they're free, quote unquote, you know, the true cost is another podcast, but their services that they offer to consumers are free. Amazon, there's no evidence that they're using their dominance to raise prices. And Apple is kind of in its own world over here, but they didn't get very many questions.
Yeah, well, I can imagine they didn't because they, like Microsoft, have been able to put themselves in a bit of a higher position, not quite holier than now, but at least a position where they are saying we're acting on principle and any problems you have with us are just your problems with our principle.
Right. They did get some questions about the App Store, which is the one area where there is some question of whether there are meaningful competitors. But anyway, to answer your original question, Congress has a very hard time making laws right now. There isn't any serious legislation floating around that would change antitrust laws. There's a divided Congress. It's just not very likely right now. Now, this has become a topic in the 2020 presidential race. Senator Elizabeth Warren is really leading the policy conversation with a proposal to break up big tech companies and unwind their previous acquisitions. If she were elected and was able to really charge ahead with that agenda, maybe we could see something happen. But outside of that, it's hard to envision a scenario.
All right. There was one more surprise twist, and that was in Europe, where obviously it's a different regulatory regime. The European Union has its own ways of pursuing companies for antitrust. And there, Amazon made news this week as well.
Yes, that was what made this the antitrust week. So the European Union has opened a formal investigation into Amazon over third-party sellers, this issue that we've been talking about for this whole podcast. And it is a different environment. Europe has competition rules that are more focused on market dominance and not as narrowly focused on consumer prices like we have here in the US. And the current European Commission has made a habit of going after American tech companies. Google's been fined more than $9 billion in total. And they have also gone after Qualcomm and Facebook. And that is an area where we could actually see something serious happen. Amazon could be fined millions or billions of dollars. They could face orders to change their behavior. So that's really one to watch.
So what happens in Europe from here?
The European Commission will investigate Amazon, and they're going to be looking at two issues specifically. One is whether Amazon abuses its power to disadvantage third-party sellers in its marketplace. And the second is the buy box, which is this valuable piece of real estate on Amazon.com where retailers get recommended products from other services when they're on a product page.
Right. And so like you're on the product page and then there's that little box there and it's sort of there can be different people selling that product. And so the buy box is sort of the preferred version that Amazon elevates for you to purchase.
Right. And the commission wants to get a better understanding of who is selected for that box and why. So the investigation has started. There are no rules governing how long it has to take. No deadline has been set. And Amazon says it will fully cooperate with the investigation. So that's really a stay tuned one.
All right. This is fascinating stuff. And as you say, it sounds like there aren't any real near-term practical implications for the company other than it has to speak out more in its defense. But it'll be fascinating to see who wins the White House in 2020. And what impact that has.
Yes, it's definitely something to watch. It's an issue that's gaining momentum, but not necessarily having immediate impacts.
All right, we will be right back with the Random Channel.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
You're listening to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop with Monica Nicholsberg. It's time for the Random Channel, that moment of the week when we talk about the random items we were buzzing about behind the scenes this week. Go ahead, Monica.
My random channel is not so random since it's a story that we ran on GeekWire this week, but it's very much impactful to me personally because I was going to take a Reach Now home from work today. I don't have my car because it's in the shop, and lo and behold, Reach Now has shut down.
This is interesting. There was a big joint venture that was struck between two of the car giants of the world, Daimler and BMW, and they essentially brought their operations together in a variety of ways. And it looks like one impact of that will be Reach Now, which was operating in Seattle and Portland, will essentially be giving way to the Car2Go service.
Car2Go wins.
Yeah. So that's really fascinating. It's interesting. We're talking about antitrust stuff.
Yeah.
One question that the representatives were asking of these various companies is about situations when they would acquire and then shut down services.
There's a name for it, right? Like buy and kill or something.
Yeah, exactly. So Reach Now, which was not national, it was just Seattle and Portland, is going to be no more.
Goodbye, Reach Now.
And this was an interesting service. And I really like this variation of the car sharing services, the free floating ones where you can just pick up the car anywhere versus Uber and Lyft where you call it and it comes to you. It was typically cheaper than getting a ride from an Uber or a Lyft, so I would often look for it. I have to say that Lime, in terms of their experience for their cars, the Lime Pods, I think they call them, I found that user experience much better than the Reach Now experience, personally. I struggled with Reach Now with connectivity issues. Sometimes I felt like I was getting charged an extra 5 minutes because I couldn't get the car to lock
right
afterward. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I haven't tried the Lime Pod cars yet. I've used their bikes, but maybe that's how I'll get home today. I have to find a new transportation option because when you have a dog, it's really nice to have a car that you can drive yourself rather than ordering a Lyft and then calling the driver and asking if it's okay to bring the dog.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, so we will link to Taylor Soper's coverage of that on GeekWire from the show notes on this podcast. You can also find that story on geekwire.com. My random channel item, Monica, relates to a podcast we had earlier this week. If people didn't hear it, I'd recommend they check it out. Alan Boyle and I put together a show all about the Apollo 11 moon landing. Alan talked with three people who were at NASA in mission control for the Apollo missions, and it was a fascinating glimpse behind the scenes. And I wanted to say, if you liked that podcast, I ended up stumbling across a fantastic podcast that basically takes that concept and extends it out for a full season. The BBC World Service has a podcast called 13 Minutes to the Moon, and it is astonishingly good. It's all sorts of behind the scenes stuff about the final 13 minutes that it took to go from lunar orbit to the surface of the moon and everything they encountered in between. That's sort of the dramatic focus of the podcast. And of course, they tell all the stories around it. And whoa, just off the charts. Amazing.
Really?
Yes.
I've never thought that deeply about that narrow slice of time. You know, I've thought about the overall landing, but that's interesting.
You know, to me, the big insight, and I realize that this is probably obvious to people who study space, but the moon is a long way away. It's 225,000 miles.
That is far.
And, you know, one of the points that one of the former flight directors that Alan talked with made was, you know, this is not like being in Earth orbit, and it's actually going to be difficult for today's flight engineers to figure out that extra complication of being 225,000 miles away as commercial and U.S. and other space ventures try to get us back to the moon. But yeah, it's like that is one thing that comes across really clearly in this podcast is you are communicating with folks who are just way, way out there. They're not just right up there at the moon. I mean, it's a long way.
Right. Yeah, it makes you wonder how we'll ever get to Mars, but it seems like some people are very sure it's happening.
And the other point that some of the folks made to Alan was the moon and Mars really in the scope of what humanity is going to be capable of long term. Those are just very small steps. Two small steps. And the other thing that cracked me up, I really started nerding out about all of the old TV footage of the moon landing. You know, Walter Cronkite came about a split second within walking all over Neil Armstrong's famous line.
Really?
Yes. Like Walter Cronkite was just sort of talking, you know, obviously it was a historic moment and he was clearly in his own Walter Cronkite way reflecting that. But yeah, he wasn't like giving enough air, ironically, to Neil Armstrong to say his thing. And then the two broadcasters, Walter Cronkite and his colleague, they didn't understand what Neil Armstrong said when he first said it. So they were like, oh, what did he – that was his quote. What did he say? And if you go back and listen to our podcast earlier in this week, I played some extended versions of them trying to figure out what he was saying when he said one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, which, of course, we now take as just like this iconic statement. Of course, that's always been out there, right? No, there was a moment when they had no clue what he was saying.
Yes, and of course, you would zero in on the once-in-a-lifetime journalistic challenge of trying to cover the moon landing and not step all over it.
Exactly, exactly. All right, good stuff, Monica. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Todd.
Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.